It's our great pleasure to have here the Vice President responsible for jobs, growth, investment, and competitiveness, all in one portfolio, to talk about the famous plan for investment. I think Vice President is very well known here, but it's sometimes interesting to follow a little bit the national career of people who then come to high positions in Brussels. And I noticed that you have a master's degree in social sciences, and from that you went straight into politics, into the national parliament, with various positions in your own parties, then finance minister, and then prime minister. And now we have you here in Brussels with a very ambitious initiative of the commission. And without that, I would like to give you the floor immediately, Vice President, and then perhaps you will take some questions from us and from the audience. And I have noticed that you have to leave imperatively by 10 past 2. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I will speak from there. So here is one recorder. Does somebody expect me to take this to the other place? I will do it. Dear ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for the kind invitation and opportunity to exchange views on the State of the Union in 2015. In the course of your discussions today, you will have a chance to debate many of the key challenges we must face together, ranging from energy security to labor market reform, and from managing migration to the challenges in our close neighborhood. All these challenges require new thinking while staying true to our values. The contribution of think tanks such as those represented in this room can have a big impact on this discussion. Our values have been tested in recent months and weeks, but we have also seen Europe as at its best, coming together in a spirit of solidarity to stand up for what we believe in. We must have confidence in our values and trust in each other. This is the basis for moving forward in Europe. The role of the Commission is to uphold the treaties which embody our values and enforce the rules of the Union, which is the basis for trust, mutual trust. As you know, a new team of commissioners took office at the beginning of November last year under President Jean-Claude Juncker. While still a candidate for that job, he set out in July last year his 10 priorities in his political guidelines called A New Start for Europe, an agenda for jobs, growth, fairness and democratic change. The new commission is fully committed to delivering in line with the endorsement we have been given by the European Parliament and the Member States. We are well aware of the urgency and have got straight down to the business. We are approaching, but not yet past, the 100 days milestone when US presidents have traditionally taken stock of their effectiveness. This milestone dates back to the time of President Roosevelt, who took office at a time when his country was in the teeth of depression and needed bold action to kickstart growth. Before saying more about what we are doing, let me also say a word about what we are not doing. This year's Commission work program, published in December, is different. It is based on the political guidelines of President Juncker, which means that we have screened all those proposals on the table in the light of these priorities. We therefore chose to withdraw a number of proposals, some of which are to be modified. Where we find unnecessary or overly burdensome regulation, we will act to remove it. We will be bigger and more ambitious on big things and smaller and more modest on small things. This will require a different way of working, and indeed this commission is also set up differently. Commissioners will take on larger, more meaningful portfolios and 7 vice presidents will be in charge of coordinating the work of the college, breaking down silos to ensure we build proposals in a coherent way and acting as a strategic filter to ensure we focus on what matters. I think this new way of working could have a very big impact over time. It is still bedding down, but we have a strong and experienced team of commissioners in place committed to ensuring that this time it really is different. Just 3 weeks after taking office, this commission produced a communication on an investment plan for Europe. In line with the first priority of the political guidelines, this communication set out a roadmap to reverse the downward trend in investment and help boost job creation and economic recovery without waiting on national public finances or creating new public debt. The fact is that even allowing for the bubble effect pre-crisis, investment in Europe is still some 15% below where it should be. This is hampering both the demand and supply side of our economy, and we need action on both. I see plan very much as a triangle with three key elements designed to help the EU take a decisive step towards meeting the long-term needs of our economy and increase our competitiveness. Perhaps the most immediate visible element is the new European Fund for Strategic Investment, EFSI. After some intensive work inside the Commission, we published the legislative proposals for EFSI at the beginning of this year, and we want to see it adopted before the summer break. We have had our first exchanges with the Parliament and with the Member States at ECOFIN yesterday, and I'm very encouraged by the positive responses and constructive engagement we are seeing. In fact, some of the money can already start flowing now via the European Investment Fund even before the proposal is formally adopted. EFSI has been designed to provide additional risk-bearing capacity to the European Investment Bank, which will allow them to crowd in private sector finance for projects. We know that there is plenty of liquidity in Europe, but it is not being translated into investment. We think EFSI can be part of the solution. The second important element in the plan is the project pipeline and European advisory hub. We are stepping up technical assistance at all levels and deepening our cooperation with national promotional banks. We have already identified more than 2,000 projects worth 1.3 trillion euros. So there is real demand for project finance and investors who are willing to put up money. We need to get them talking to each other, and potentially the EFSI contribution can help close the deal. We want to ensure that investment decisions are taken by real experts, not politicians, so as to reassure potential private sector participants that the decisions are based purely on technical expertise, not political bargaining. We will resist sectoral or geographical quotas, but we also know that SMEs and mid-caps have specific financing needs that are not currently being met. We have therefore set aside a quarter of the EFSI financing capacity for these emerging companies, who are the innovative job creators of our future. Finally, let me particularly highlight the critical importance of the third element in a triangle: an improved investment environment through a deeper and wider single market with better regulation at its core. For me, this is the most important element of our plan and one that can really change Europe permanently for the better. That brings me to some other key priorities for this Commission that have already been flagged up in the political guidelines and in the 2015 work programme. Investment is truly a golden thread that weaves together everything that we do. A connected digital single market is a top priority for creating jobs creating growth and jobs in Europe and is being taken forward by my colleagues Andrus Ansip and Günther Oettinger. Energy union steered by Maro Šefčovič and Mikel Cañete is essential to lessen our dependence on imported fuels and meet our climate objectives. Both of these sectors need major investment as well as regulatory reform, and that is why the EFSI draft regulation specifically refers to them as a priority areas, where additional risk-bearing capacity could make a real difference to their prospect of securing the necessary financing. In addition to target sectoral measures, we are working horizontally through initiatives such as Capital Market Union, which was on the agenda of today's college meeting, under Jonathan Hill, which is intended to open up alternative sources of finance. A deeper and fairer EMU, the responsibility of Valdis Dombrovskis and Pierre Moscovici, will consolidate the progress that has been made in governance, while Frans Timmermans will oversee our commitment to better regulation and sustainability, not just inside the Commission, but also in partnership with other institutions. Our own multi-annual financial framework will be revised next year by Kristalina Georgieva, and perhaps there could be another policy area where can make our scarce resources go further using innovative financial instruments along the lines of the EFSI model. I could go on, but that all these examples are intended to show is that the new Commission collectively and individually is focused on making Europe a better place to invest. Investment is what will shape our long-term prospect and give us the short-term boost we need to secure the recovery. This is not just a financial calculation either. To come full circle in my remarks, it is also about our values and what makes us European. We need to ensure a strong social dimension in everything what we do, underpinned by strong institutions and the rule of law, and positively engaged in the world around us. In other words, we need to invest in our people, in our partnership, and in our planet. By investing in people, I mean giving them the skills they need for the 21st century economy, offering hope and real prospect for the future. We need to give them the confidence to take risks and develop their own businesses, encouraging new entrepreneurs and helping them to get access to financial resources and the world's largest single market. We need to manage the mobility of people inside and outside the union in a way that supports economic growth and social cohesion, protects against external threats, and contributes to international development. By investing in partnership, I mean we need a new understanding with our member states and the European Parliament on how we can work together to deliver for our citizens. I have begun a roadshow to all 28 member states to explain what the investment plan is all about. I really value the input from the social partners who have a critical role to play in making this work on the ground in a way that reflects the specific characteristics of each member state. By investing in our planet, I don't just mean green technology, even though I'm convinced this is a crucial sector where Europe has a real competitive edge as well as political leadership role. I also mean we need to invest in other countries, starting with our neighbourhood where the needs are clear and pressing, both in East and South. The reality of investment is that it is now a global phenomenon and a two-way street. The EU is the world's biggest source and destination of foreign direct investment. Agreeing on a new framework for the I in TTIP will set global standards and reflect our values. To conclude, therefore, the investment plan in its broadest definition encompasses everything that we do in the Commission to provide the fresh start and EU citizens desperately want, whether they live in Athens, the Alkaria or Arctic Circle. This Commission is at the beginning of the 5-year mandate and we need to set a long-term agenda. But we also need to respond to the urgency of the moment. The challenges are great, but so are our assets. No other region on Earth at any other time of human history has provided such a high quality of life to the great majority of its people. We should recall what we have overcome in the past and invest now to secure our future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for this very wide-ranging speech, which went much beyond the 315 billion, which everybody in the room is expecting. We all realize that a bit more than just finance is needed to get Europe going. But perhaps now I can give the floor to Arthur Goes, who is one of the co-organizers, co-organizing institutions of this event, to address a couple of questions.
First of all, I have to apologize that we are here sitting on two sides of you, attacking you from left and right. it looks like a football player who is going to that goal. And well, after the meeting, you will see whether we were supportive or whether we are attacking you. But what you said indeed went a little bit beyond the EFSI. And you put it in the context which resonates very well with the theme of today, a new departure for Europe. And therefore, I also want to ask two questions. One question is about the potential investment areas where you listed energy, education, infrastructure, R&D. You have over 200 projects, 2,000 projects. So is there a rather pragmatic approach with which projects to choose, or do you have a strategic focus in one of these areas? What is the kind of rationale behind the mechanism of selection of projects? A second one is somewhat more political, because it is said that the activities of the EFSI will be subject to structural reforms in the member states. Now, I've been involved in some structural reforms in the Netherlands, but also we've seen in other countries it's extremely complicated. And it also might be that your counterparts for the investments are not all the time national governments. So how is that mechanism of subject to structural reforms? Well, ECB measures are subject to structural reforms. Stability and Growth Pact put their activities subject to structural reforms. We all want to see structural reforms. How can EFSI make the difference in putting a well-chosen incentive on these structural reforms? These are maybe two initial questions.
Thank you very much. First, I want to clarify the principle of the new fund. Without any member states' contribution, it can lend some 60 billion euros, which is supposed to mobilize something like 250 billion private resources. The leverage ratio is somewhat lower than average EIB lending result has been. So EIB lending, the leverage is 18 times 18, and now we are talking about times 15. Yeah. And the reason for this lower leverage, I mean, nobody can guarantee this, but this is the best guess we have. Yeah. Due to the fact that the new fund will invest in riskier projects, the ones which cannot be financed purely by private sector, neither by EIB, because it cannot take this much risk. So the leverage ratio is probably lower. But the more it invests in SMEs, the higher the leverage is. Yeah. Currently, EIF, the European Investment Fund, is lending to small and medium-sized enterprises, and there the leverage is huge, because every single cent public lending will crowd in a huge amount of private resources. And this is the logic behind us. So Riska projects, it must crowd in private resources. The fund is not used 100% public investment. Those are the principles. The areas where we are planning to provide loans, first of all, SME side, and the second, the projects which will support the other policy targets we have, like tackling climate change, creating energy market union, like better connections, interconnectors between the countries or within a country, transmission lines across the border, or creating better potential growth, like investing in innovation surrounding, or investing in new energy technologies. The prototype of good investment which could benefit from the fund is a pilot project of some new energy technology. Okay. So we want to support, by lend riskier projects which would support the other policy area we are trying to achieve. How this will reflect with the structural reforms in national level? It's true that most of the reforms which will improve competitiveness are on the hands of governments. But sometimes, for instance, if we had a better single market on energy or in digital, it would help create a better business surrounding in national level. Or this is our aim. So that's why the investments, physical investments, or investments in entrepreneurship will help the member states to do the structural reforms. Many of our economic challenges at the moment in our member states are mostly structural in nature than cyclical. My final point is, which I want to highlight, is that the Commission will focus heavily on internal market. We have been in a situation where we have needed to defend our credibility and confidence because of the financial crisis for many years. 7 years we have been tackling, or we have been more or less in crisis management mode. We have created six-pack and two-pack and banking union and stuff. And now we want to change our focus to creating something new which will give new opportunities for people and business. That's why digital single market, energy market union, capital market union, and services and goods, internal market. And this will be, if I should say what is the common nominator of this commission, it's the focus, strong focus on internal market. One final remark, political remark. The fact that we are focusing on internal market development is the big positive project for many years, which can include everybody. There is no borderlines between south and north in internal market. There is no borderline between pro-European or a little bit more skeptical in internal market. So this is politically also very important. Everybody can be on board building stronger and better Europe.
So do I understand that subject to structural reforms is not that this is a conditionality the project, but that is an assessment that the project would help a climate for structural reforms?
Exactly.
Okay, thank you.
I think this last point is quite important, since we have a new government in one member country which has explicitly said that it will roll back structural reforms. So they can count anyway on having a project financed in their country, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, when looking at Greece, I've been told by some private sector people that there are economically viable and interesting investment opportunities. But because of the country risk, the private sector is not willing to invest in those objectives. And there, the new fund could partially share the country risk or whatever the risk there is, and thus enable to normal business activity to happen and also increase. This is very crucial in order to strengthen potential growth increase and in order to strengthen job creation. By the way, Greece is the second or the third best doing economy in terms of growth figure in Eurozone at the moment. This year we expect Greece to grow something like 2.7-2.9% and next year even more. So it would be very good if new investment initiative would help them to get in investments and therefore more jobs.
Okay, I won't comment on that one, because if I hear that the EU is taking over the political risk, that presumes that the country, successive governments in that country, will honor their commitments to the EU.
Yep.
And right now we have a government which says, I don't want to honor the commitments which previous governments have taken for my country.
The Commission expects the Greece fulfill their commitments to the other European citizens. And this is very crucial in order to keep the business climate in positive direction, because we don't need uncertainty. We have just got to the point where confidence have started to increase. And we also see that the positive growth figure and positive primary surplus are due to the fact or comes from growth-friendly reforms, which are desperately needed or have needed to do. And there is a list of measures which should be done in the next years. So no one can replace the national responsibility. We can share the business risk or investment risk in some extent, but if the surrounding is not favorable for job creation, then no one can help.
Thanks a lot. I don't think we should dwell further on Greece. I mean, as you have said yourself, this is a program which comes at a time, or the plan comes at a time where there's ample liquidity in the market, which now has been amplified by the ECB. And as you can imagine, a skeptic says, in this sea of thousands of billions of money flushing around, you add 16 billion of risk-bearing capacity, and that should have a meaningful impact. You can imagine that some people are a bit skeptical. But let me put that aside. When I look at the aims of the plan, I ask myself whether they fit with the financing that you have in mind. And I give you two examples. One is internal market, energy, and the famous interconnectors. Let's take a concrete case, Spain and France. Neither of the operators on both sides has an interest in seeing these interconnectors built, because they bring more competition in their own backyard. And the private return to building them might be rather low. The social return might be rather high, because it makes competition stronger on both sides. So that is a typical case where the social return is high, private sector low. So with 6% additional capital from you, will that be enough to get something like this built? And a similar observation applies to investment in human capital, which you rightly said is so important. And I saw some investment plans in Italian schools and so on. Investment in human capital is, again, something where the social return is very high. The personal return, whoever receives it, is also high. But the private sector return to those who are providing this stuff is usually pretty low. So when you emphasize the leverage and the contribution of private sector capital, then you must, by necessity, limit yourselves to projects where the private sector return is extractable It's visible in monetary terms and can be extracted. I don't see that happening in the internal market for energy. I don't see that happening in the area of investment in human capital.
So there's a kind of exaggerated expectation that new fund can change everything. If you compare the amount of lending capacity of the new fund, it's 60 billion if the member states doesn't want to put any additional capital. 60 billion in 3 years. The EIB, normal EIB lending is 60 to 70 billion per year. Mm-hmm. So many of the projects in human capital side could be partially financed by EIB if just the public sector itself is capable to take the loans to their balance sheets. So we cannot force anybody to invest in anything. The reason or the purpose of creation of the new fund is that we know that there is a lack of risk financing. And if there are projects, or if there's a need for additional SME funding, then the new fund can help. But it cannot finance everything, and doesn't. And also the basic idea is to provide risk financing in order to mobilize private financing. Totally other issue is the public, purely public investment. Also, I tend to think that human capital can be raised or increased through education or research or things like that, but also innovations done by SMEs, for instance. Kind of SME or startup activity, it is one way to increase human capital. Because if you can provide equity or guarantees to SMEs, innovative new SMEs, they can start their businesses and they can do innovations from the principal or basic research. So, yeah, it's the new fund will not solve everything, and that's why we wanted to add two other angles to the plan. And as you can see, this is not the whole plan, is not the one of Stevens measure. It's more like a structural change in Europe, including single market and project pipeline and risk financing sources.
That's very interesting. So it's not a stimulus measure?
Not one of stimulus measure in its traditional mean, which starts and ends.
Okay. We have time for a couple of further questions from the audience. Maybe if you could introduce yourself very briefly and ask question, not making long statements. I see a first hand here. There are microphones in your seat, number 2 and number 3. Okay, those in the back have a disadvantage because it's very dark, but I see some hands.
Mr. Vice President, it's clear, I think we're all agreed, that the stimulus plan is actually a political signal. It's not remotely the same as Roosevelt's New Deal. It's not going to stop us going into deflation and maybe a Great Depression. Listening to your run-through of the plan, two questions occurred to me. First of all, a lot of your plan is like previous plans, which are founded on member governments' failure to implement what they'd agree to. So my first question, is there more of a mood of naming and shaming in this commission than in previous ones? Second question, Mr. Juncker sold the commission as the last chance commissioner, last chance commission. Any thoughts on how we'll know when or even if we've turned the corner?
I will take a couple of to collect them, number 2 and number 3 there. In your seat. There's a button to be pushed, I think, or...
No, it picks up.
Hi, Jack. Okay. Yes. Thank you.
My name is Mr. Sheikh Ruhu. I'm a professor at the HEC School of Management in Paris. I'm a Tunisian citizen from Tunisia. And my question is, this presentation is extremely attractive, and the remembrance of the former president of the United States when he had to face such a big, big dilemma is very relevant. But there is something that has not been mentioned. Europe is about to start a very, very weird, quote-unquote, monetary policy, this quantitative easing. Quantitative easing has been used in the United States. It has favored virtual economics. Are you sure that with quantitative easing in Europe, we are not going to see virtual economics? That means, you know, high-frequency trading things like in London expand, and real economics and real job creation and real wealth creation not expand. That's a risk.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Stephanie Titzke. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on the third pillar, on the framework conditions, and what your plans are, how to improve them. Thank you.
Okay, propose we close the first round, and if we have time, we then take a second round.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you very much. About naming and shaming, that's very good that you raised this issue, because I have raised this same method before in the European Council when we were dealing with six-pack legislation. And the European Council was discussing for the first time on scoreboard and country-specific recommendations and how well the member states have implemented all those recommendations. I think we have to use this method more, because there are areas in which the Commission doesn't have, or the community doesn't have, competence. But there's a clear need to harmonize things. And also, especially in single market part, there are countries who have not implemented all the legislation, and it hampers the investment. But also, I mean, we don't basically have a single market, even though we have a legislation for it. So, naming and shaming, kind of peer pressure, is a good tool, and we shouldn't be too modest to use it. It's not a negative tool. I mean, you can see it happening everywhere.
But as I may say, so as Prime Minister of Finland, it was easy to to propose naming and shaming, because you knew where you were going to stand. And now in the Commission, things will be a little bit more difficult.
Yeah, but we must speak openly if we cannot deliver everything only due to the fact that something is politically difficult. Because things are used, I mean, the easy things have already been done. There are only difficult things left. So that's why we have to use kind of because we are the union of values, union of rule of law. And that is also one additional explanation why we have to use naming and shaming, in order to encourage or to make it happen that everybody's living according to the same rules. When or if we ever can turn a corner, I don't know when this will happen, but I have been several times in a similar situation where it has been very easy to stick to cynicism or to skepticism and to start looking at that glass is half empty. And I think we are in a situation in which we just have to believe in something and deliver fast, and look after a couple of years or 3 years what we have achieved. Just to go ahead fast and do things and accept that everything is not perfect. We are in Europe. We are living partially in the illusion of perfect solutions. There is not perfect solutions for complicated issues. This is same with in the political level. Populists are giving simple answers to complicated issues, and everybody should understand that if you see very complicated, difficult task, and somebody is offering you very easy, simple, and even nice answer, it's most probably wrong. So that's why we should accept that once we are delivering fast, according our beliefs, according our values, we are doing changes. There are also losses. But the movement, I'm kind of Perstein socialist. I believe that the movement is the most important thing at the moment. By the way, I'm not a socialist. But QE, whether it's create a virtual economy instead of real economy. I suppose not to comment on ECB's policy, but in general terms, I think there is or half of our problem in Europe is that we are lacking of demand. Another half is lack of supply. So there is a need for a wide range of policies, of which monetary policy plays a crucial role. But the fact is also that all the countries cannot benefit similarly from ECB's actions, because all the countries are not capable to deliver. They are not competitive enough to benefit from better demand stimulus. But in aggregate level, I believe the ECB's actions will help. And the third pillar, single market part. I cannot tell you the concrete proposals on digital single market or energy market or capital market union at the moment, but those are the areas in which we have to move on. It's quite amazing, like Andrus Ansip, who is in charge of digital single market, he's really furious when he's talking that it's easy to buy a tie from Paris by Estonian credit card. But if he tried to buy TV channels from Paris by Estonian credit card, the credit card issued in Estonia, the shop service says that you cannot buy this because you have this kind of credit card. And by the way, you wouldn't see those channels because they are only for the French. So we have a whole economy which is national in borderless Europe. This is ridiculous. For our small and medium-sized companies, there is a fantastic single market in digital content, for the digital content and project in the United States, but unfortunately not in Europe. So that's why we need a set of proposals, including copyright regime, data protection laws and stuff, to be harmonized in order to create a new market. And this is nobody's fault. But during the last few years, we have concentrated mostly on crisis management. And before that, there was not basically digital content, to be a little bit black and white. And that's why we don't have digital single market in Europe. And also in energy sector, it has always been very national. But there is a need in terms of energy efficiency, in terms of energy security, we need more harmonized regulation and interconnectors. So I really believe in this third pillar because, as I said, it's a positive political agenda for everybody, and there's a real need for this.
Yep. One quick round?
Yes.
And this time I wanted to go, back because
actually, there's some... Actually, only one question, I would say, because
okay,
I
was one question on the back there on the right. Okay, why don't you go ahead very quickly?
Thank you very much. My name is Jean-Pierre Kempeniers. I work at Royal Philips here in Brussels. First of all, Vice President, thank you very much for your presentation. And thanks to the think tanks for this session. When would you call the investment package a success? And what's the biggest challenge? What can energy efficiency mean for your package? And lastly, probably my most important point, is public support. We are making further integration steps, and at the same time, public support is dwindling. How to tackle that problem? Thank you very much.
4-1.
So when we can say that the plan has been successful, once we have managed to make a major change in the areas, various areas of internal market. If we manage to create internal market within next few years in those areas I mentioned, then I would be very happy. Also, if private sector finds the new transparent project pipeline as a fascinating source of projects, which boost institutional investors, for instance, to invest in European infrastructure, then I would be happy. Also, if the new risk fund appears to be the one which can really make a change in small and medium-sized enterprises level, and also which could attract private resources to the areas of business, but also geographical areas to which the private resources wouldn't go otherwise, then I would be happy. The energy efficiency plays a big role because this is exactly one of our policy area in which we want to improve. And there, hopefully, we can use, for instance, the fund as a tool to encourage new innovative technologies. Or the private sector to boost the private sector to invest in new innovative technologies. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do you allow me to wrap up in 1 minute?
We will move straight into the next session on migration, and Matthias Meyer will chair it from that point.